Welcome to the North Carolina Reading Service. Today is Monday, November 4th. Your readers are Joe McFeeters and Kurt Benrood. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired and is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast by visiting our website, www.ncreadingservice.org. This broadcast is generously supported by The Forest at Duke. They can be reached at 800-474-0258. We thank them for their contribution. We'll begin by reading the USA Today Newsline section, followed by the Money, Sports, and Life sections. At 8:30 p.m., our featured program will be Drug and Department Store Ads. And now it's time for primetime TV listings.
TV listings on ABC tonight at 8 o'clock. NFL football, Tampa Bay Buccaneers at Kansas City Chiefs. The Chiefs bring a perfect record home for this Monday night football game meeting with the Buccaneers. On CBS at 8 o'clock, The Neighborhood, Welcome to the Vote. At 8:30, Papa's House, podcast. At 9 o'clock, Sticks and Stones, NCIS receives intelligence on deadly threats to multiple locations that could lead to war. 10 o'clock, NCIS Origins, Last Rites. Franks faces off with a killer on death row to find a missing body before time runs out. On Fox at 8 o'clock, 911, Lone Star. Naked Truth. A man gets crushed under a vending machine. Owen faces the truth of his brother's death. At 9 o'clock, Rescue High Surf, POW. An influencer gets swept into the ocean while filming a video. Mayor Emerson makes good on his word. At 10 o'clock, WREL's 10 p.m. news on Fox 50. On NBC at 8 o'clock, The Voice, The Battles, Part 5. The battles conclude as the coaches prepare their artists to go head-to-head in dueling duets. At 10 o'clock at Saturday Night Live, the 2024 SNL election special. On ION at 8 o'clock, FBI, All the Rage. A bus explosion kills several innocent people. At 9 o'clock, another episode of FBI, Remorse. The president of the New York Fed is gunned down. And at 10 o'clock, a third episode of FBI, Stay in Your Lane. The team works quickly to find the motive behind a murder. On PBS at 8 o'clock, Antiques Roadshow, celebrating Native American heritage. At 9 o'clock, Frontline, The Choice, 2024, Harris vs. Trump. The lives and characters of Kamala Harris and Donald Trump ahead of the 2024 presidential election. On MNT at 8 o'clock, Dateline, House of Horrors. At 9 o'clock, Law and Order, SVU, Criminal Hatred. 10 o'clock, Law and Order, SVU, Monsters Legacy. On CW at 8 o'clock, Superman and Lois, When the Lights Come On. At 9 o'clock, Driving the Vote. At 10 and 10:30, National News Desk. On A&E at 8 o'clock, Hoarders, Mary Lynn. Mary must clean up or face a dangerous recovery. Another episode of Hoarders at 10 o'clock, Where Are They Now, Ruth and Sybil. On AMC at 8 o'clock, a three-star movie, Point Break, made in 1991 with Keanu Reeves, Gary Busey, and Patrick Swayze. And at 10:45, a two-star movie, Roadhouse. On BET at 8 o'clock and 8:30, episodes of Martin. At 9 o'clock, a two-star movie, The Bodyguard, made in 1992 with Kevin Costner. On the Disney Channel at 8 o'clock, Primos, also Primos at 8:30. At 9 o'clock, it's Place, 9:30, Place, Mortal Vibes Only. At 10 o'clock and 10:30, Jesse. On the Discovery Channel at 8 o'clock, it is Contraband Seized, The Cocaine Preacher, another episode of Contraband Seized at the airport at 9 o'clock, What a Trip. And at 10 o'clock, Contraband Seized at the Border, Tomato, Tomato. On ESPN At 8 o'clock, NFL football. This is the Tampa Bay Buccaneers at Kansas City Chiefs. The Chiefs bring a perfect record home. On Nickelodeon, starting right now at 7 o'clock, a two-star movie, Hotel Transylvania 2, made in 2015 with the voices of Adam Sandberg, Selena Gomez, and Adam Sandler. And from 9 o'clock up through 10:30 are episodes of Friends. On TNT, starting at 7:30, it's women's college basketball, Michigan versus South Carolina from T-Mobile Arena in Las Vegas. And at 10 o'clock, further college basketball. And finally, on USA at 8 o'clock, WWE Monday Night Raw at 8 o'clock. And at 10, it's Based True BD, and 10:30, Fast and Furious.
Okay, taking a look at the front page of today's USA Today, there's an article titled, Prepping for Protests and Possible Violence. Election officials outline efforts to protect ballot counting. We'll be reading that a little later. Another headline reads, Apples not what they were years ago. Experts give lowdown on this favored fruit. Again, we'll read that after a bit. And the fourth one here is titled, Steeplejacks Take Work to Great Heights. Fixing flagpoles and smokestacks, rare breed keeps fading trade alive. And that also will be read after a bit. And right now I'm going to read one that says, Poll Chaplains Safeguard Right to Vote. Add calm. On Tuesday, the Reverend Dante McGilvery plans to be outside an Arizona polling place, doing his damnedest to save American democracy from going to hell. The chaos is increasing the closer we get to Election Day, he said. We are called by God to do justice, and as clergy, that means to put yourself in the midst of where the potential chaos is. McGilvery serves as pastor of outreach and social justice at Phoenix's First Institutional Baptist Church. But on that day, he'll enlist in a more civic-minded role as one of the hundreds of nonpartisan, so-called poll chaplains, sentried outside national polling places to ensure people feel empowered to exercise their right to vote. Nationally, religious leaders say such efforts align with their faith callings and are crucial at a time when voting itself has become politicized. Voter suppression efforts, disinformation, and violent rhetoric, they say, have undermined people's confidence in the process and eroded their sense of security. Protecting the rights of voters is something that should matter to all Americans, said the Reverend Adam Russell Taylor, among the leaders of Faiths United to Save Democracy, which operates the nation's largest poll chaplain initiative. We want to be messengers of truth, combating disinformation, and providing moral witness around the need to finish this election in a way that is fair and safe. Mudslinging on both sides has intensified in recent years, with polling sites and vote-counting centers dragged into the battle. The election outcome has been cast in apocalyptic proportions, with each side preaching that should the other side prevail, the forces of evil will have won. Marching into that fray will be hundreds of poll chaplains and peacekeepers, priests, pastors, rabbis, and imams, as well as nuns, deacons, choir directors, and Sunday school teachers. Their mission? To be a calming and moral presence, to field questions about the election process, and to employ de-escalation techniques to prevent or quash any efforts to harass or intimidate voters. Results of a poll released in August 2022 showed only 41% of voters felt safe at polling places, including just 28% of black people and 37% of Latinos. A third of those surveyed worried about weapons at polling places, while 3 in 10 said they feared polling place harassment of black or Latino voters. Bridget Moix, who served as a poll chaplain in Ohio in 2022, recalled being outside a Cincinnati area polling site when a young black man approached the site nervously before going inside. When he finally exited, he said his demeanor had completely transformed, all smiles. "Looks like that went well," she told him as he passed. "Yeah," she recalled him replying, "I thought there would be guys with guns here." "That stuck with me," said Moix, General Secretary for Friends Committee on National Legislation, a Quaker peace and equality organization that is among Faiths United for Democracy's national partners. "I'm certainly sobered by the realities we are facing as a nation and trying to be prepared for whatever might happen at my polling, at my individual polling station and in the broader electoral environment." Protecting sacred right to vote, especially for vulnerable people. Approximately 1,000 poll chaplains and peacekeepers from the Faith United to Save Democracy campaign will target key zip codes in 8 battleground states, in addition to Arizona and Ohio. Alabama, Florida, Georgia, Michigan, North Carolina, Pennsylvania, Texas, and Wisconsin, where Election Day problems are believed to be more likely. That is part of the campaign's broader efforts to uphold the integrity of the American democratic process through an interfaith coalition led by Sojourners, a national faith-based media and advocacy organization. Skinner Leadership Institute in Baltimore, and the Center on Faith and Justice at Georgetown University. "We think everybody's well-being as Americans is on the line," said Barbara Williams Skinner, Skinner Leadership Institute's co-founder and CEO. "This is about making sure the sacred right to vote is safeguarded by for everyone, particularly the most vulnerable." The January 6th insurrection of 2021 ushered in what a Reuters investigation showed is the largest and most enduring rise in American political violence since the 1970s. The news agency has documented more than 300 incidents since, including a pair of assassination attempts this year on Republican candidate and former President Donald Trump. And in Arizona, several recent shooting incidents at a Democratic campaign office near Phoenix forced the site's closure last month. A Maricopa County attorney's office prosecutor said a 60-year-old man arrested in connection with the shootings was preparing to commit an act of mass casualty. Authorities found more than 100 guns in his home. Just 17 states have clear bans against guns at polling places, according to the Movement Advancement Project. Several more have prohibited them in part. Other sites related to the voting process have also come under attack. The day after the 2020 election, police removed protesters from a vote-counting center in Detroit for disrupting the process and intimidating workers. The protesters, many incited by Trump's baseless claims of fraud on social media, banged on the center's windows and doors as a truck circled the site with voice on a large speaker, repeating the charges. In 2022, masked and armed members of a group monitoring ballot drop-off boxes in Arizona were ordered to stay at least 250 feet away after complaints of voter intimidation. Sometimes it's the poll chaplains themselves who are harassed. McGilvery, co-head of the national campaign's Arizona efforts, recalled an Election Day incident in 2022 when he and April Hawkins, who also serves as a pastor at First Institutional Baptist, were stationed outside a polling site at a library in downtown Phoenix. Having seen McGilvery and Hawkins in their collars, an older man who had just voted approached them and asked what they were doing. When Hawkins explained their roles as poll chaplains and members of a local church, the man asked for whom she had voted as a Christian. She said, "We're just glad you cast your ballot," McGilvery remembers. The man wouldn't let up, pressing the two about whether they'd voted a certain way. The man's wife soon joined in, echoing her husband's sentiments, with the couple becoming more irate as a crowd began to form. "I just said, 'We're glad you voted. Have a great day,'" McGillivray said. He was like, "You're not real Christians." The whole episode lasted about 10 minutes. The poll chaplain's calm demeanor was meant as much to reassure other voters as it was to keep tensions from escalating, he said. And their mission is even more important now. "Our hope is that people will see us and feel some sense of security and calmness, knowing there are faith-based organizations helping to protect them," McGillivray said. Aiming to restore faith in the election process. Faiths United to Save Democracy grew out of a previous effort, Lawyers and Collars, that had united attorneys and clergy to protect rights of primarily black voters. The group changed its name as it became a more multi-faith, multi-racial national coalition of more than 50 denominations and other religious groups, built around the idea that protecting the right to vote is a core expression of one's faith. "The right to vote has become overly politicized," said Taylor of Sojourners. "We want to restore faith in the elective system and make the right to vote a moral and bipartisan cause." Mobilizing Election Day poll chaplains and peacekeepers marks the campaign's third phase, following voter education efforts and meetings with election officials to build relationships and let them know the campaign will hold them accountable throughout the process. Sites selected to be staffed by poll chaplains are within zip codes identified as vulnerable locations, generally impoverished areas where voter suppression efforts, including new voter identification requirements or barriers to mail-in voting, have occurred, or where threats of violence have taken place. The civil rights movement helped to win everyone the freedom to vote, but it came at a great cost and sacrifice, and the black church played a great role, Taylor said. "We feel like we're carrying on some of that tradition." In Georgia, the Reverend Cynthia Hale worries about the threat of violence given the political atmosphere. In 2020, she said, "We had situations where men have driven in by pickup trucks with guns in the back, and we don't know how far those threats are going to go." Hale, founder and senior pastor of Ray Hope Christian Church in Decatur, Georgia, leads the national campaign's state efforts. "In a consequential election, and our democracy is on the line," she said. "I have confidence that our Secretary of State has done everything possible to make sure we have a safe, free, and fair election." "That kind of accountability is crucial," she said, "especially given the accusations of voter fraud that followed the 2020 election in Georgia. Such disinformation remains rampant despite multiple audits that showed no evidence of wrongdoing. All eyes are on us, and we want to make sure we get it right, that we don't have any trickery," Hale said. Some of the polling places at which Georgia's 60-plus poll chaplains will be stationed in Atlanta, Macon, and Savannah have been hampered by sparse or undependable voting machines, she said. "These are places where they tend to break down," Hale said. "There are longer lines. People are basically inconvenienced in every way possible." In Wisconsin, the Wisconsin Council of Churches partnered with the Wisconsin Interfaith Voter Engagement Campaign to launch a state program that will place more than 70 poll chaplains at polling sites in cities such as Madison, Milwaukee, Green Bay, and Racine. "Their role is to be present on Election Day and be a peaceful presence at the polls," said the Reverend Brianna Alene, the Council's Director and Ecumenical Innovation and Justice Initiatives. "We recognize that there are questions about our democracy and folks who may not feel safe." Alene said the program's poll chaplains are clergy who will be at polling sites to help answer questions. But it's also about adding that layer of trust in case there are issues. Like, hey, I was there, and I saw the process worked well. As with the national campaign, Wisconsin's effort aims to monitor the state's checks and balances to help people understand and trust what can be a complex and lengthy process. Given the political climate, she said, clergy are overwhelmed, anxious, and eager to be involved. We said, let's identify one way and provide a really clear ask, Eline said. Have them show up on election day and be a friendly, smiling face and invest in this process. People see our current political division, and it's helpful to give them something to do. And the last section here is titled, We Will Be Vigilant Through January 6th and Inauguration Day. For its 2024 campaign, Faiths United to Save Democracy added a fourth phase given the events that followed the 2020 election, including the January 6th insurrection at the U.S. Capitol, with plans to monitor state vote counting and certification processes in order to prevent sabotage. This year's efforts will extend beyond Election Day, with prayer vigils planned and poll chaplains assigned to locations where subsequent phases of election process, such as the meeting of the electors, will be conducted up to and including Inauguration Day. We will be vigilant through January 6th, when electoral votes will be counted by Congress, and through Inauguration Day, Taylor said. We have seen officials refuse to reject political violence or to accept the outcome if they didn't win, and this has arguably been the most volatile environment we've had in a long time. Faith leaders involved in these projects see their goal of protecting the democratic process as part of their spiritual duties. Hale, Georgia's campaign lead, said, Principles of justice and equality align with major faith teachings of love for God and one's neighbor. Voting is a precious gift that has been given to us as Americans, and as people of faith, it's important for us to make sure everyone has the opportunity to participate in a safe and fair way, Hale said. Taylor agreed. Essential to many faith traditions is the commitment to protect the most marginalized, he said. And given rising voter suppression efforts, we see this as part of our core commitment, since it's often poor voters who are targeted. We think our democracy is stronger when more people are able to exercise their freedom to vote. In Phoenix, McGilvery said he's inspired by the fact that faith leaders were among those leading the charge during the civil rights movement. Initiatives like this show that faith leaders are still on the ground and putting themselves on the line, understanding that anything can happen, he said.
Right, this is USA Today's Election 2024 series, entitled Prepping for Protests and Possible Violence by Sarah D. Weyer. The bushes in front of City Hall in Green Bay, Wisconsin, have been removed. On election night, the street out front will be blocked off. These hardening measures were suggested by the city police chief to protect the ballots being counted inside, said Celestine Jeffries, Green Bay's city clerk. As threats against election workers have grown more violent, election officials across the country have spent months coordinating to protect voters, ballots, and poll workers at an unprecedented level with emergency management agencies. Amid that coordination, the centralized locations where ballots are counted on election night have emerged as a key place needing protection. More than a dozen county and city election officials spoke with USA Today about what they are doing to make sure they can count ballots at central ballot counting locations once polls close, no matter what happens outside. Election officials have built new warehouses where ballots will be counted under increased security. Local and state law enforcement have run through multiple scenarios for large crowds descending on the ballot counting locations. Some jurisdictions have reduced the number of observers allowed to attend and require them to obtain credentials far in advance. Despite polls showing a toss-up race in key swing states, former President Donald Trump is already saying he can only lose if there is massive fraud. He has, without evidence, named Detroit, Milwaukee, and Philadelphia as places where fraud could occur. Some prominent pro-Trump Republicans are already saying supporters will go to ballot counting locations if the winner of the presidential election isn't clear on Election Day. Retired Lieutenant General Michael Flynn, Trump's first White House national security advisor, who played a central role in 2020 efforts to overturn the election results, said on October 20 on the right-wing podcast American Truth Project that results should be known on election night. Otherwise, Flynn warned, I do feel like people are going to go to those locations where there's counting, and there could actually be violence because people are so upset after 2020. Jim Birch, president of the National Policing Institute, a nonprofit research organization, told USA Today the central ballot counting facilities have become an incredible point of potential risk and concern. Danielle Alvarez, senior advisor for the Trump campaign and RNC, said in a statement that they have recruited over 230,000 volunteers for their election integrity program to bring transparency and accountability to our election processes. Election officials are responding to fears that could occur in 2024 and to the reality of what happened at the central counting location in Detroit in 2020. The day after the 2020 election, a crowd of Michigan Republicans, primed by months of Trump's baseless claims of massive voter fraud and that he'd won the election, hurried to the convention hall in downtown Detroit, where mail-in and military votes were being counted, argued with police and election officials, and banged on windows while they chanted, "Stop the count." On X, formerly Twitter, Flynn's associate Ivan Ranklin, a former Green Beret and retired Army Reserve Lieutenant Colonel, said last Monday that Americans should be planning to descend on states and counties where they do not finish the election count by midnight November 5 in order to document, audit, and live stream every movement and breath of every single poll worker, election official, to assure they are motivated to guarantee a free, fair, and transparent election. Lawrence Norden, vice president of the Election and Government Program at the Brennan Center for Justice, said his biggest fear about post-election violence is if one candidate declares victory before the ballots have all been counted and while it is still unclear who won. That is the period of time where there's an information void and emotions are running extremely high, Norden said. That's when you get the crowd showing up, threats against election workers, election officials who are doing their jobs. In 2020, Trump declared victory hours after the polls closed, even though it was too close to call and neither candidate had secured the 270 Electoral College votes needed to win, and ballots were still being counted across the country. Days later, Biden secured the Electoral College votes needed to win. In Chester County, Pennsylvania, about 40 minutes from Philadelphia, Voter Services Director Karen Barsom has been meeting with representatives of county agencies for months. This is not a clerk, me, sitting in an office like maybe 20 years ago. This is a big operation that needs everyone from this county almost to be helping with and on standby from the district attorney to the sheriff to the Department of Emergency Service, she told USA Today. All 300 county staffers have been trained on what happens at the central ballot scanning facility, including emergency training by the Department of Emergency Services, she said. God forbid you're at a station and there is an envelope that has white powder. This is how we are going to conduct ourselves. This is how we're segregating it. This is how we segregate a person. This is how we evacuate, Barsom said, paraphrasing the training. Local election officials
nationwide have changed procedures or built new facilities in anticipation of people potentially trying to interfere with counting ballots. Jurisdictions of all sizes expect intense public scrutiny of election administration. Paulina Gutierrez, the Milwaukee Election Commission Executive Director, said every person going into central counting now has to go through security and is only allowed to carry one bag. Posted signs will explain the rules in preparation for large crowds, and city attorneys will be on site. They've also reduced the observation space, so it will be harder for a large crowd to gather, she said. Any member of the public can show up at any of our polling sites and central count, and we are expecting large crowds, Gutierrez said. In Washoe County, Nevada, home to Reno, election workers are now monitored by overhead cameras as they count ballots, with panic buttons installed in the case of an emergency and security badges to limit access. And because election observers have sometimes tried to harass workers counting ballots, the county installed a soundproof glass-fronted penalty box to keep them separate. The new election facility in Fulton County, Georgia, home to most of Atlanta, was specifically built to have wide windows where the public can view every part of the process to be as transparent as possible, said Nadine Williams, Director of Registration and Elections. The fire marshal will keep a close eye on how many people enter the building, she said. We are concerned about the large crowd that we can possibly get on election night. We've been doing scenario trainings and things of that nature to prepare. In Maryland, Baltimore County's new central building for election administration was designed with transparency and security in mind, says election director Rui Lavoy. If anyone wants to come and watch us till 4 in the morning while we upload the results, they're more than welcome to do so, she said. Santa Fe County, New Mexico clerk Catherine Clark said tabletop exercises with local law enforcement, the FBI, and the Federal Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency have been useful. There's always going to be things that happen, and because that election has to happen no matter what, absolutely no matter what, you have to have contingency plans in place, she said. The National Policing Institute is one of several election advocacy and law enforcement groups that have held meetings with law enforcement across the country on how they can help election officials protect not just staff, but ballots and the ability to count them. Safety of the central ballot counting locations has been a focus, Birch, the group's president, said. Law enforcement is being asked to think about elections in a way they never had to before. They are preparing for protests and civil disobedience, along with providing security for months of campaign stops, weeks of early voting locations, polling places on election day, and at the ballot count location for days afterward. Changes to procedures in Detroit and state law in Michigan should make it harder for a larger upset crowd to gather and disrupt the count, Daniel Baxter, chief of operations for Detroit, told USA Today. In 2020, challengers, a person who is appointed by a candidate or political party to observe the process on their behalf, just had to sign a piece of paper to enter the tabulation area. Now they have to provide credentials showing they pre-registered with one of a dozen groups that signed up weeks in advance to have challenges in Wayne County, which includes part of Detroit and the surrounding counties. Everyone entering will have to present identification, be credentialed in advance, and pass through metal detectors manned by Detroit police officers. An initiative petition passed by Michigan voters in November 2022 also allows local election administrators to start pre-tabulating absentee ballots before the election and limits how many challengers can be present during pre-tabulation and on election night. Ballot counting was moved from the basement to a new hall within the convention center where there is more space to work and there are no windows to bang on, Baxter said. Baxter, who has worked in the office since the mid-1980s, said election officials have always talked with law enforcement about protection and security, but this year is different. It includes lessons learned from last presidential election, what state and federal law enforcement are hearing, and the threats other election officials have faced. Everything that we're doing for the 2024 presidential election is rooted from what our experience was in 2020, he said. Law enforcement will help ensure that ballots and memory cards holding ballot data make it to the central count locations from the precincts. Everything that we do will be under police escort to ensure a tranquil and smooth operation and transition of all of these items, Baxter said. Officers will be visible on every street around the convention center and will be in parking areas to keep ballot counting staff from being hassled or an aggressive crowd from interfering with counting the ballots. We just want to make sure that every area is covered. While we hope for the best, we plan for the worst, Baxter said. Jeffries, Green Bay's clerk, said she began thinking about contingency plans a year ago. She took the job in 2021. My clerkship is in a post-January 6th environment. I have always been concerned, and I've always worked closely with the police department on our security, she said. So Jeffries quickly agreed when the police chief suggested removing bushes at City Hall and closing off the street out front while ballots are counted. That came about as a result of some information the police chief had received, and also his professional judgment that we needed to, quote, unquote, harden where central count takes place, she said. I leave the intelligence gathering to the police department, and I trust them.
Okay, I'm going to go through our announcements here, and then we'll switch on over to the opinion section. So let's celebrate with Arts Access. Join Arts Access as they culminate this milestone year with our Ruby Celebration. Enjoy a fun evening of entertainment, fabulous food, live and silent auctions, awards and recognitions, and more. General admission tickets on sale at artsaccessinc.org. And this happens Friday, November 15th from 7 to 10 p.m. at Marbles Kids Museum, 201 East Hargett Street in Raleigh. 10 tips from the North Carolina State Board of Elections for Voting Day. Go to your assigned polling place on Election Day. Across North Carolina, more than 2,650 polling places will be open from 6:30 a.m. to 7:30 p.m. on Tuesday. Voters in line at 7:30 p.m. will be able to cast a ballot. To find your polling place, use the voter search tool on the state board's website. Find your sample ballot. Voters can use the state board's voter search tool to locate their sample ballot. The sample ballot looks just like your Election Day ballot. Pull up your voter record, then scroll down to the Your Sample Ballot section. For information on candidates for the State Supreme Court and Court of Appeals, see the State Board's Judicial Voting Guide 2024 General Election. Election officials do not provide information about candidates for other contests, but some media outlets and advocacy groups do. Many candidates also have websites and social media accounts. Be familiar with your ballot choices, and it will help your voting experience go more smoothly. Bring your photo ID. Oh, yes. Voters will be asked to show photo ID when they check in to vote. Voter registration is not permitted on Election Day. While that is the general rule, voters who become eligible after the regular voter registration deadline of October 11th, either due to becoming a U.S. citizen or having their rights restored following a felony conviction, are still permitted to register on Election Day. Absentee ballot drop-off. Voters who still need to return their absentee ballots can drop it off in person at their County Board of Elections office, either during business hours on Monday or on Tuesday, Election Day, before 7:30 p.m. Voters registered in the 25 counties in the Helene disaster area in western North Carolina may return their absentee ballots to any elections office in the state. Ballots will be kept secure and delivered to the voters' County Board of Elections for processing. Voting in person instead of absentee. Voters who requested an absentee ballot but have not yet returned it may choose instead to vote in person on Election Day, November 5th. Voters may discard their absentee ballot and do not need to bring it to their polling place. Voters in need of assistance may bring an eligible person to help them enter and exit the polling place or to help them complete their ballot according to the voter's instructions. Election officials are also available to help voters. People assisting voters while they are completing their ballots are not permitted to influence the voters' choices. Curbside voting is available for voters unable to enter the voting site. State and federal laws forbid intimidation or interference with voters. This includes hindering access to the voting place, whether inside or outside the voting site. It is a crime to interfere with election officials carrying out their duties. Penalties for violations include prison time, a fine, or both. The State Board takes these incidents very seriously. When they occur, we will work with our law enforcement partners to respond. Voters who are harassed or intimidated should notify an election official immediately. Election results will be posted on the State Board's website. See the election results dashboard. See also the election night reporting timeline for information on when the public can expect unofficial results on election night. And finally, peace at the polls. If you are participating in the election as a voter, poll worker, observer, or campaigner, please treat others with dignity and respect. We know the political climate in our country is tense. But let's make North Carolina a model for accessible, safe, secure, and accurate elections. Tactile tours are available at North Carolina Museum of Art. They're designed for visitors who are blind or have low vision. They're led by a docent, and they explore the museum's collection through audio description, tactile experiences, and by engaging the senses. Tours are available by request only. You must arrange them at least 2 weeks in advance. To schedule a tactile tour, please contact Accessibility Coordinator Molly Mull at mmull@ncartmuseum.org. You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, connecting people who are blind and print impaired to each other, their families, and communities by delivering news, information, and entertainment using the latest audio technology. In addition to using specially tuned subchannel radio receivers, NCRS streams our programming on our website, ncreadingservice.org. You can listen by using the Listen Live streaming audio player located in the upper right-hand corner of our website pages. If you have an assisted technology device, such as Alexa or Google Home, just say, "Tune in NC Reading Service to listen instantly." We also provide podcasts of over 50 magazines and other information and entertainment programs following the initial broadcasts. Please visit our website, ncreadingservice.org, and click on the Listen tab and then click on Skip to Podcast section. For more information, you can call us at 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening. And have you gotten your free currency reader yet? The Department of Treasury's Bureau of Engraving and Printing is now providing a free currency reader to all eligible blind or visually impaired individuals. The device is small, compact, and runs on AAA battery, which is included. To use the currency reader, simply insert a U.S. bill into the reader and press the button. The device will tell the note's denomination. To request your currency reader, fill out an application form, which is available to download at www.bep.gov. It must be signed by a competent authority, such as a doctor, who can certify your eligibility. Then simply mail it to the address on the application. Once your application is verified, a reader will be mailed to you at no charge. For more information about the U.S. Currency Reader Program, visit www.bep.gov or call toll-free 844-815-9388. That's 844-815-9388. And now we're talking about the opinion section. This says, Trump's plans would harm public education. And this is by Maria Bautista, who is a military fellow columnist at USA Today in the opinion section. Former President Donald Trump is using public education as a weapon in his campaign for the White House, continuing to fight against diversity, equity, and inclusion programs, and even threatening to shut down the Department of Education. He's not alone. The Republican Party has consistently attacked public schools and teachers' unions while promoting vouchers and other initiatives that drain resources from classrooms. The idea of shuttering the Department of Education has been a GOP rallying cry for decades. I recently watched an interview with Trump on Fox and Friends, during which he claimed, "We're going to take the Department of Education, close it. I'm going to close it." Trump's vow reflects a broader agenda, like the one described in the Heritage Foundation's Project 2025, aimed at reducing federal oversight in education and limiting government spending on essential services. Republicans have long criticized the Department of Education. The Department of Education was founded in 1979 during President Jimmy Carter's administration to help improve educational access and increase federal funding for schools. Republicans criticized its creation, claiming it was an overreach of the federal government's role and an expansion of bureaucracy. Although efforts to dissolve the department have been unsuccessful, the idea of eliminating it keeps alive the small government rhetoric used by the GOP during election season. Republicans argue that the federal presence in education stifles creativity, inflates spending, and undermines local governance. Federal oversight helps to ensure equality. But the federal government provides education funding that includes student loans, special education grants, and Title I dollars for schools that serve low-income students. Shutting down the department would potentially take away billions of dollars in federal money that school districts rely on. Since its inception, the department has enforced civil rights laws in education, ensuring that students with disabilities, minorities, and other marginalized groups receive equal treatment and opportunities. Eliminating that oversight would remove federal protections for these groups and lead to more disparities in our nation's public schools. As Americans, we must recognize the danger of allowing education to become a casualty of political rhetoric, and we must continue to fight for equal access to education instead of weaponizing it.
Okay, now we're going to go to the money section. This first article is entitled IVF's Cost Becomes Election's Key Issue by Bailey Schultz and Jessica Gwynn. Having kids isn't cheap. For Bree Sison and her husband, making one wasn't either. Sison and her husband, Sam Stewart, started trying after Sison's father was diagnosed with colon cancer in 2016. It took 3 years, one surgery, multiple attempts at intrauterine insemination, and one round of in vitro fertilization. But it worked. They had a daughter in 2019. But without insurance covering the $40,000 tab, fertility treatments, not to mention other expenses such as student loans, daycare, the mortgage, have twisted the family's budget into a financial vise so tight that there is little left for college or retirement. Stewart, who already traveled for a good chunk of the year as a member of the Army National Guard, is now out of the house for months at a time as a defense contractor. "It feels a lot like I'm a single mom most of the year," says Sison, 40, of Richmond, Virginia, "but that is a direct result of the debt." This election cycle, The desperate search for financial relief is on the ballot for families reeling from the high cost of infertility treatments. 15 states offer some form of IVF insurance coverage laws, according to infertility advocacy group Resolve. Many of those without insurance are forced to take out personal loans or second mortgages to afford infertility treatment that can cost more than $10,000 a cycle. About 1 in 8 reproductive age women say they or their partner needed fertility assistance services at some point, according to a 2024 survey from KFF, a nonprofit health policy research and news organization. 14% of those women reported receiving in vitro fertilization, a type of assisted reproductive technology where eggs are combined with sperm in a lab to form embryos. Courtney Dede and her husband had been trying to conceive a baby for nearly 10 years. When filling out her ballot, Dede said she pores over candidates' records to see where they stand on insurance mandates or tax incentives. As the community support director for the Building Military Families Network, a nonprofit that supports military and veterans family, Dede, 34, travels to Washington to lobby Congress for affordable access to reproductive care. The financial pressures for military families, whose benefits often don't cover fertility treatments, are especially acute, she said. This is not about red or blue, she said. Infertility is a disease just like cancer. Every round of hope and heartbreak has taken a heavy toll on this National Guard family from Ohio. The steep costs, $100,000 out of pocket so far, have also stymied their efforts to have a child. Each year, the cost of testing, medication, and transfer goes up. Dede holds down several jobs, as does her husband, but it's still not enough. They have just one embryo left, but they couldn't move forward right now, even if they were ready. With high interest rates, they can't afford to take out another personal loan. We are still hopeful it will take, but we have to be able to afford that, and we just can't right now, Dede said. Voters are looking to former President Donald Trump and Vice President Kamala Harris for solutions. Nearly 6 in 10 want to hear the candidates talk about IVF, according to a KFF poll. We've never seen fertility services so explicitly become a campaign issue being discussed by candidates, said Yusha Ranji, Associate Director for Women's Health Policy at KFF. Caroline Levitt, a spokesperson for Trump, said he would support universal access to IVF. On the campaign trail, Trump has pledged to cover the cost associated with it as well. Trump's campaign did not share cost estimates. Under the Trump administration, your government will pay for, or your insurance company will be mandated to pay for, all costs associated with IVF treatment, Trump said at a campaign event in Michigan in August. We want more babies, to put it very nicely. Vice President Kamala Harris has been vocal in her support for IVF, but has not laid out plans for expanded fertility coverage. After an Alabama Supreme Court ruling in February that frozen embryos created during IVF are children, Harris laid the blame for the fertility treatment crisis at Trump's feet, saying it was a direct result of the Supreme Court overturning Roe v. Wade. There is only one candidate in this race who trusts women and will protect our freedom to make our own health care decisions. Vice President Kamala Harris, Harris campaign spokesperson Sarafina Chitka, told USA Today. Regardless of who wins the presidential election, coverage for IVF faces an uncertain future. A national mandate for IVF insurance coverage would likely require congressional approval. That would be a tough sell if Republicans win the House or Senate, according to Barbara Colora, CEO of Resolve. With both presidential candidates, there's a potential for positive movement, she said. But if one of the chambers is Republican, we're probably going to have a more difficult time. Figuring out who would pay for IVF could be a major sticking point. Kalura said IVF has yet to break the bank in states which require coverage. She pointed to data from Massachusetts, Connecticut, and Rhode Island, which have required infertility benefits for more than three decades, that suggest infertility benefits account for less than 1% of the total premium costs. Vanessa Brown Calder, Director of Opportunity and Family Policy Studies at the libertarian think tank Cato Institute, estimates that requiring IVF coverage would cost the government about $7 billion a year. If expanded insurance coverage leads to a spike in IVF demand, she estimates annual costs could balloon to $43 billion. IVF was thrust into the national conversation after the Alabama Supreme Court ruling. While polls show the overwhelming majority of Americans support IVF, some oppose it because the procedure can mean the destruction of unused embryos. Senator Tammy Duckworth, Democrat, Illinois, who sponsored the Right to IVF Act, and other Democrats argue the treatment is an essential part of reproductive health care. Sean Tipton, Chief Advocacy and Policy Officer of the American Society for Reproductive Medicine, said supporting IVF is a harder sell for many in the GOP. Members of Congress tried and failed twice this year to pass bills that would protect IVF access. The bills were blocked by Senate Republicans. Donald Trump's statements in support of IVF and in support of requiring insurance coverage for IVF are something that we are very happy to hear, Tipton said. On the other hand, to put it generously, they lack specificity. So I think it's hard to know. When Chicago-area Republican strategist Cullen Colbert, 38, and his wife Abby welcomed their first son in March after more than 3 years of IVF, his phone was buzzing with notifications claiming the GOP and his presidential nominee did not support the procedure. From his daily conversations with hundreds of conservatives across the country, Corbett says he knows that's not true. A nationwide survey last year by former Trump aide Kellyanne Conway's consulting firm on IVF and fertility treatments supports that contention. It found robust support in conservative circles, including 78% of people who identify as anti-abortion and 83% of evangelicals. IVF, which is something so personally important to me and so important to so many families, especially as birth rates are declining around the country, this isn't the kind of issue that we should make a political football, Corbett said. If you want to play games with some other issues, fine, but this is genuinely life. It's the future of many families. It's an economic challenge for many families. He said he and his wife had insurance coverage and owned their own business. IVF still wiped out their savings. I can't imagine a working family struggling to get by that wants to have kids. I don't know how they could ever bear the cost, Corbett said. It's absolutely part of the cost of living equation for families right now, and I think more elected leaders, more candidates, need to speak out about it. Some voters told USA Today they are skeptical Trump would follow through with his IVF promises. He's given me no reason to believe anything he says Sisson, the former IVF patient from Virginia. With conservatives, I don't trust them, particularly on that issue. Sisson says she has voted Republican most of her life, but is backing Harris and her running mate Tim Walz, whose family also had fertility struggles. He understands the desire to build your family or to be a parent, to have all this love to give, and it's out of your control. He gets that, Sisson said. A recent KFF survey of women voters found Harris holds a 2-to-1 advantage over Trump when it comes to who is trusted to do a better job deciding policy on access to abortion, birth control access, and IVF. Stephanie Vojas Taylor, 41, a lawyer and mother of two from Chicago, conceived her first child through in vitro fertilization after struggling to get pregnant. Worried that the Supreme Court's decision to overturn Roe v. Wade in 2022 could jeopardize fertility treatment for other families, she helped draft an update to Illinois law to protect access to IVF and other assisted reproductive technologies. The depths of despair that you have when you can't have a baby, I would not wish that on my worst enemy, said Vojas Taylor, who estimates she and her husband spent about $50,000 to have their eldest son. We need Republicans and Democrats to agree that people should have access to this treatment. because at the end of the day, it's just about giving people options and increasing their odds of having a baby.
Okay, it's just about time to switch over to sports, so I'm just going to read a little bit from each of two other Moneyline articles. This first one says, Disney World gets more magical for holidays. It's beginning to look a lot like Christmas at Walt Disney World, which seemingly transformed from Halloween to holidays overnight. It'll take a little longer for all the decorations to go up, but guests will notice increasingly more holiday spirit in the air over the next month, culminating with Epcot International Festival of the Holidays kicking off after Thanksgiving. And the other headline I'm going to read says, report, just 12,000 jobs added last month. Unemployment rate in U.S. held steady at 4.1%. Employers added just 12,000 jobs in October as hiring slowed substantially. The total was expected to be constrained by two southeast hurricanes and several worker strikes, but the tally was far lower than what was estimated, and job gains for previous months were revised sharply downward, raising concerns about a weakening labor market. The report provides a final portrait of the economy just days before next week's historic election and key Federal Reserve meeting, but the temporary hurdles likely will make it challenging for Fed officials to get a reading of the labor market's underlying health, economists said. The unemployment rate held steady at 4.1%, the Labor Department said Friday. Before the report was released, economists surveyed by Bloomberg estimated that 105,000 job gains were added in October. Also worrisome, payroll gains for August and September were revised down by a whopping 112,000. August's additions were downgraded from 159,000 to 78,000, and September's from 254,000 to 223,000. Okay, and so moving on to sports here, this article is titled, Five Teams You'll Likely Hear From in March. Like all cliches, there's more than an element of truth in the coaching adage that it isn't important where you start, but where you finish. It's especially applicable to preseason polls, which are based strictly on potential. Once again, we'll try to identify a few teams that didn't crack the USA Today Sports preseason college men's basketball top 25, but could end up there when trophies are awarded and the nets are cut down. Texas Tech, in a league where five teams occupied the top nine spots in the preseason poll, there are going to be ups and downs during conference play, but the journey in the Big 12 should help get the Red Raiders battle-tested when the time comes to make a tournament run. The foundations of their success under Grant McCasland and predecessors Mark Adams and Chris Beard was defense. That won't change. But there will be enough scoring to win games with holdover Darian Williams getting help from transfers J.T. Toppin from New Mexico and Elijah Hawkins from Minnesota. Rutgers. The Scarlet Knights weren't totally snubbed as they appeared on enough ballots to finish second among others receiving votes. The hype for Rutgers is based largely on the arrival of a pair of top five recruits. One is Dylan Harper, brother of former Knights standout Ron Harper Jr., who had the genes to step in immediately to run the point. The other is Ace Bailey, an athletic swingman ranked second only to Duke commit Cooper Flagg by many recruiting outlets. These two, along with Jeremiah Williams, who averaged 12.2 points despite missing a huge chunk of last season due to injury, could make some noise in the Big Ten that is more wide open this year. Xavier. It's easy to overlook the Musketeers if you look at last season's 16-18 record, but the team was hit by an injury crisis and limped its way to the finish. Should the group stay healthy, it has the talent to make a run at finishing second behind Connecticut in the league. It starts with the return of big man Zach Fremantle, who has missed the better part of two seasons. He provides a presence in the middle and has support on the perimeter from returning starter Davion McKnight. Sean Miller brought in a host of transfers to make the team deeper, including Ryan Conwell from Indiana State, Dante Maddox from Toledo, and Marcus Foster from Furman. And Wake Forest. Every ACC team not named Duke or Carolina could have appeared on the snub list. We will concede some skepticism is warranted for the Demon Deacons, who have not been dancing since 2017. But the pieces might be in place to end the drought after fifth-year coach Steve Forbes. The optimism starts with Hunter Salas, 18 points per game, who went through the NBA draft evaluation process but decided to return. Also returning are backcourt mate Cam Hildreth at 13.8 points, who played with a broken wrist for much of last season, and center Efton Reed III, scoring 9.6 points and 7.9 rebounds. And finally, Boise State, the Mountain West, advanced six teams into the tournament and had two teams ranked on Selection Sunday. There are none in this year's preseason poll. The Broncos were voted the favorites to win the league with Tyson Degenhart and Omar Stanley as the two major reasons. Degenhart, with 16.7 points and 6.2 rebounds, is the conference's preseason player of the year and is joined on the first team by Stanley and San Jose State transfer Alvaro Cardenas. Another addition from the portal who could provide scoring punch is Javon Buchanan, who played for NAIA school Indiana Wesleyan.
All right, now we'll continue with Dan Wolkin's column, ACC Wants to Pump Up NCAA Respect Early. Dateline Charlotte. Over the last three runs through March Madness, no conference has had more to celebrate than the ACC. Four different programs reaching a men's Final Four, filling seven of the 24 spots in the Elite Eight, and earning 33 overall tournament wins. In all three categories, the ACC has been the best-performing conference despite ranking fourth over that span in a number of tournament bids, which is exactly the problem as the ACC sees it. Why has this become college basketball's Rodney Dangerfield conference? Why can't it get any respect? It doesn't really make any sense, says North Carolina State coach Kevin Keats, whose team contributed to that March success by making a surprise Final Four run last season. The disrespect continues. The preseason USA Today Sports College men's basketball coaches poll finds only two teams worthy of a ranking, Duke at number 5 and North Carolina at number 10. Meanwhile, the ACC is bigger, with additions of California, Stanford, and SMU bringing the league to 18 members, and maybe better as a whole, with some recent bottom feeders potentially getting their act together. But in the end, there's no doubt Commissioner Jim Phillips has a mandate to improve the ACC's positioning relative to its peers in the eyes of the NCAA Tournament Selection Committee. For a league whose history and tradition are intertwined with college basketball, receiving 15 total bids over the past three tournaments, while the Big Ten and SEC has gotten 23 and 22, respectively, is an embarrassment and an outrage. We have to tell our story better, Phillips said. But the ACC doesn't merely have a narrative problem. The reason for its low bid count is mostly just math. The analytics used by the committee to sort and seed teams, which are largely influenced by non-conference performance and schedule strength, haven't flattered the ACC recently. Since going to a 20-game conference schedule 5 years ago, ACC teams have had fewer opportunities early in the season to put non-conference wins on the board. And whether it's transfer-heavy teams struggling to gel early or a disproportionate number of teams going through difficult coaching transitions, ACC teams have carried too many bad losses and too few good wins into conference play where they can boost each other's computer numbers. That's how you end up with a team like Wake Forest going 13-7, 10-10, and 11-9 in the ACC each of the last 3 years and ending up on the wrong side of the bubble every time. And it's especially hard to take for coach Steve Forbes when, as an example, his team last season logged wins over North Carolina State, Duke, and Clemson, all of whom ended up in the Elite Eight, but didn't quite have a good enough resume to get in the at-large bid conversation. We didn't win the right games, Forbes said. What happens when you're on the bubble? The pressure builds. It's just not fun. We had some huge wins, and then you lose a couple of road games you probably shouldn't, and it costs you when you're on the cut line. Phillips said the ACC commissioned a detailed statistical analysis to help teams optimize their non-conference scheduling as it relates to the NET rankings, the primary tool the NCAA uses to group teams in quadrants. In basic terms, teams improve their NET by beating top 30 opponents at home, top 50 opponents on a neutral court, or top 75 opponents on the road. They hurt their NET by losing at home to teams ranked outside the top 75 or losing in any venue to a team outside the top 100. Some critics of the NET think it's too easy to game the system and it doesn't necessarily reflect the true quality of a league, especially when one has grown as big as the ACC. However, math is math, and you're better off figuring out how to make it work in your favor. But you also have to win non-conference games to feed good numbers into the machine, and that's something only ACC teams can control. We need to be smarter as a conference the way we schedule non-conference, and we have to control winning, Duke's John Shire said. But still, for me, playing in the ACC and coaching the different styles of play, the different teams you play prepares you the best for the tournament. There's nothing you don't see. The numbers in March have proved that, and when you look at how many different ACC schools have gone deep in the tournament. It's not just Duke and North Carolina. The league probably has been undervalued. But a huge piece of the puzzle will be figuring out how to get some of the league's traditionally strong programs back on track. There's little doubt that the disaster at Louisville in two seasons under Kenny Payne, the significant downturn at Florida State, and the slippage in the final seasons of Mike Bray at Notre Dame and Jim Boeheim at Syracuse contributed to the bad analytics and public perception. And that path gets even more complicated when you consider Tony Bennett's shocking decision last month to retire at Virginia. When you combine that with the recent exits by Mike Krzyzewski and Roy Williams, Boeheim and Bray, no league has had to replace so many legends in such a short period of time. Every league is going to go through this at some point, Forbes says. It's one reason why my agent told me to take the job, because these guys are going to retire. There's just been a lot of transition, but I think we're stable. When the season begins, ACC fans will be closely watching the bottom of the conference. First-year coach Pat Kelsey looks like he's on the path to get Louisville going pretty quickly. Damon Strohmeyer has elevated the talent at Georgia Tech. There have been good signs from Boston College, and Micah Shrewsbury's track record at Penn State should translate to a successful rebuild at Notre Dame. If those teams can avoid bad losses early on, the ACC may finally start to get some love from the committee. We have had a drag at the bottom of the conference because of rebuilds or new coaching situations or the transfer portal, and that has really influenced some of those rankings, some of the metrics overall that they're looking at, Phillips said. Whether we like it or not, the narrative starts to get set in November and in December in the non-conference games. You have to perform at a greater level.
Okay, and we'll round out the sports segment here with this short one titled Unbeaten Shockers Shake Up Coach's Poll. One college football team in the top 10 was guaranteed to lose in Week 10, but two more went down to unexpected defeats, resulting in considerable shakeup in the U.S. LBM Coaches Poll. Oregon easily retains the number one spot after taking care of business at struggling Michigan. The Ducks again received all but one of the 54 first-place votes, with the other top nod going to number two, Georgia. Ohio State moves back up to number three after handing Penn State its first loss, knocking the Nittany Lions down four to number seven. Miami, Texas, and Tennessee each move up a spot as a result. Notre Dame climbs a notch to number eight, number nine, BYU, and number 10, Indiana, both among the last of the unbeatens, round out the top 10, each receiving their highest ranking since the 2020 season. Clemson and Iowa State, the two top 10 upset victims, tumble to 17 and 18, respectively. Texas A&M also drops five places to number 16 after a loss at South Carolina. Boise State makes a big move in the positive direction, gaining five positions to check in at number 14. Colorado makes its season debut in the coaches poll at number 24, and Vanderbilt returns to the number 25 position. Illinois and Memphis drop out.
Okay, now we're in the life section. This is the health and wellness article. Crisis hotlines preparing for surges on election day by Alyssa Goldberg. On the night of the 2020 election, Caitlin Rizicki, a social worker and crisis clinician, was managing 30 conversations at a time on the crisis text line. Some were fearful for their future as part of the LGBTQ plus community. Others were concerned about conspiracy theories or media bias, and some worried that the election outcome would tear their family apart. Texters came from various political and social economic backgrounds, ranging in age, gender, ethnicity, and political affiliation. Rizicki was a crisis counselor supervisor at the time, and her job was to support volunteer crisis counselors through these conversations and intervene when needed. A significant chunk of her role involved de-escalating high-risk situations. Suicidality was frequent throughout this diverse time, this divisive time. These modes of support are needed more than ever, with 69% of U.S. adults reporting that the 2024 presidential election is a significant source of stress in their lives, which reflects an increase from 52% in 2016, according to an APA study released last month. More than 7 in 10 adults are worried that the election results could lead to violence, and nearly 1 in 3 have experienced tension and distance from their family. The National Suicide and Crisis Lifeline, 988, had a historic spike in callers on Election Day in 2016, with caller volumes rising approximately 65% above expected. Crisis text line received a notable increase in texters during both the 2016 and 2020 presidential elections, according to Dr. Sherry Turner, chief health officer at Crisis Text Line. We can't predict what 2024 will bring, Turner says, but already they've experienced an influx of conversations about election anxiety, and they expect that to rise as we inch closer to Election Day. With the election looming, crisis centers are gearing up to support texters and callers through distress, regardless of where they fall on the political spectrum. While most people will spend time thinking about the election, they can still carry on with their normal functions. But there are some people who are getting pulled deeply into all the turmoil around the election, Turner says. They may become deeply enmeshed in the news, pull away from their relationships, and experience sleeplessness, changes in appetite, and anxiety. That's when she says they should consider contacting a crisis line, though support is available regardless of the severity of one's stress. Crisis Text Line's motto, "A crisis to you is a crisis to us." Angie Anamine, a crisis counselor at Crisis Text Line and medical student at Washington University School of Medicine in St. Louis, joined the team just after the 2020 election. Now she's preparing to work her first election night. It definitely does feel kind of overwhelming sometimes on the platform when you're working a particularly busy shift or have a certain number of conversations going on at once, she says. Though election anxiety brings a surge of texters, the rest of the crisis calls don't stop. Volunteers need to be able to bounce between various election-related calls while also supporting people struggling with suicidality, depression, domestic violence, and more. And Amin anticipates a hectic night, but feels confident in the support from her fellow volunteers and staff to get through it. As those in crisis experience election anxiety, volunteers and staff are living through the same times. We're not isolated from the election ourselves. We are also in the same climate, Anamine says. That presents a challenge to us as counselors, because we need to remain politically neutral, says Ryan Dixon, the director of Crisis Community Services at Community Unity Crisis Service and Food Bank in Iowa City, Iowa. We don't weigh in with our values. We focus on the emotions of the person. For Rasiki, practicing cultural sensitivity and learning how to manage conflicting beliefs is crucial. I will never know what it's like to walk in someone else's shoes, so I can't understand, but I can always try to understand, like, what would make you want to vote for this person, she said. It was making sure I'm staying neutral about what I believe so I could support my volunteers and my texters. Often those working at crisis hotlines help each other through difficult interactions. Rasiki says part of the job is helping de-escalate some of our volunteers who are feeling triggered. Crisis lines are prepared to support their callers, texters, and counselors alike. At Crisis Text Line, the team has developed an election anxiety toolkit, which with suggested prompts, grounding exercises, tips, and external resources referrals. Supervisors prepare their counselors through role-playing scenarios, private conversations where counselors practice diffusing politically charged situations. Other techniques include helping those in crisis reframe their emotions and avoid catastrophizing through cognitive behavioral coping skills. Crisis lines encourage anyone in need of additional support to reach out on election night and beyond. Turner says they're ready for you.
Okay, I'm going to preface this article by pointing out that there is a band from the 1990s named The Offspring, whose lead singer was a fellow named Dexter Holland, and guitarist went by the name Noodles, whose real name was Kevin Wasserman. Okay, so, Offspring's hobbies keep the band supercharged. This is what it's like to prepare for an interview with Dexter Holland and Noodles of The Offspring. Do we talk about molecular biology? Lead singer Holland has his PhD in the subject. Do we discuss the merits of bird watching? Guitarist Noodles, real name Kevin Wasserman, is an avid hobbyist. What about Gringo Bandito? That would be Holland's hot sauce brand. Or how about those Iron Man competitions and piloting to piloting the band to gigs himself? Again, Holland. And of course, there is the reason the guys behind some of the most humorous and clever punk pop hits of the 90s. Pretty Fly, for a white guy. Self-Esteem. Come Out and Play. The Kids Aren't All Right. There's a reason why these are hopping on a video call in the first place. The California-bred Offspring, which includes bassist Todd Morse, multi-instrumentalist Jonah Nimoy, and drummer Brandon Pertzborn, released its 11th studio album, Supercharged, in early October. The album launched into the top 10 worldwide, including Germany, Australia, and the UK, and has already birthed the hits Make It All Right, Light It Up, and OK, But This Is the Last Time. Holland and Noodles might be 58 and 61, respectively, but their commitment to crunchy riffs and wry lyrics, in addition to unflagging energy, is undiminished. Here's what the guys had to say about their varied interests during a recent chat from their record label office in New York. Question. The worldwide success of Supercharged is not an easy feat, 11 albums into a career. Were you surprised when Make It All Right became your first song to top berth the active rock chart and alternative chart? Noodles. We're very stoked with the success. You always hope that it's going to happen, but you never know. We're super stoked and how well the song has done and how well the whole record's been doing so far. The song Come to Brazil is very funny, but are Brazilian fans really that much more fervent than fans in other countries? Noodles. They're at least among the most passionate fans you're ever going to have. Whatever you post, all the Brazilian fans say, come to Brazil, come to Brazil, come to Brazil. So it's kind of a funny phenomenon, but we wanted to make sure the song came across as a love letter to our Brazilian fans. Holland responds, Poland is really mad at us. Next question. I know you have a young drummer. At Pertzborn, joined in 1923. How do you keep that punk rock spirit alive? Noodles. I think doing what we do for a living keeps us young. Playing music, and especially fast, aggressive music, keeps you young. Mick Jagger is the same age as Joe Biden, whose lifestyle is keeping him younger. This year is the 30th anniversary of Smash. What changed after 1992's Ignition to jump to that next level? Noodles. Not a whole lot changed until after the record was done. We recorded on a shoestring budget, a lot of times spur of the moment, when Come Out and Play was given the local radio station, KROQ in Los Angeles, and Jed the Fish played it during afternoon rush hour as his catch of the day. It took off from there. Holland, that album changed our lives for sure. I look back on it really fondly because it was such an exciting time. We're lucky to have the success we have, but there's only one time you go from 0 to 100. That was the vibe that happened in 94. You both have so many hobbies. How do you find time to fit them all in? It's really easy to get out and just go for a hike and take your binoculars for bird watching. Whenever I have a day off in New York City, you can go watch birds in Central Park. Where I live, there's wetlands, hills, and you can go hike. I just like getting out and enjoying the outdoors and moving. Dexter, tell us about the half Ironman that you just did in North Carolina and what goes into the training for that. Holland, it's a triathlon, so you swim, and then you bike, and then you run at the end. I've run ever since high school, so running comes natural to me. But as we all get older, it's harder on your body, so I kind of made this transition about 5 years ago and started doing triathlons. And Noodles laughs, hey, you're not running any less, you just added swimming and biking too. Holland says, I might do 2 swims, 2 bikes, and 2 runs a week, something like that. And I might do a couple on the same day, so I'm training generally 4-5 days a week. And finally, they ask, when you say you do 2 swims, 2 bikes, 2 runs in a week, how far are you going? My last ride was 60 miles. It might not always be that far, but that would be your long ride. Your short ride might be like 20 to 30. I know it sounds masochistic. I'd like to say that I can do something like the half Ironman. It also makes other things in your life seem less hard. Well, folks, you are listening to the North Carolina Reading Service. Joe McFeeters and Kurt Benroot have been reading from the USA Today. This broadcast is generously supported by The Forest at Duke, who can be reached at 800-474-0258. We thank them for their contribution. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired and is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast by visiting our website, www.ncreadingservice.org. Tune in tomorrow at 9 a.m. for our exercise program and 9:30 for readings from the News and Observer. Up next is our featured program, Drug and Department Store Ads.